From the bright yellow studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another weedy hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Dandelions are tasty and nutritious. The leaves, flowers, and roots are all edible. I'm Mike McGrath, and you can stop groaning because on today's show, we'll reveal how to remove those pestiferous posies without chemicals or bending. Plus, it looks like a British estate, but it's just outside New York City. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and flagrantly fraudulent felicitations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you destroying your dandelions and eating them too.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the shuddering studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another avian avoidance hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we balance last week's interview about bird window strikes with a shattering tale of one bird that's fighting back. Written by Neil Vigder for the New York Times, it's the tale of a modern-day Woody Woodpecker. And we quote, "The first casualty was a side-view mirror, then another, until the number reached at least 20. The culprit apparently did not believe that it was bad luck to break mirrors. Janelle Favaloro, who lives in the Squam Hills section of Rockport, Massachusetts, put out an APB on Facebook. "We have a vandal in the neighborhood," she wrote. "He is 18 to 24 inches tall, wearing black and white with a red hat. The brazen suspect is a pileated woodpecker, one of the largest forest birds on the continent. It is easily recognized by the distinctive red stripe along its cheekbone as well as its size. Ms. Favarello has named him the Pileated Pillager. She first noticed something unusual in late March when both side windows on a van belonging to her family were broken while it was parked in the yard. A Toyota pickup next door was also damaged. Ms. Favaloro spotted the woodpecker perched on the windshield of a recreational vehicle, took a photo, and soon the image spread in the local news media and online. When he looks in the glass, what he sees is beautiful, and he's just trying to eliminate any competition," she feels, adding that you can forget about trying to get close to this woodpecker. He's off like a bullet. And because the besieged neighborhood is next to a 5-square-mile conservation area on Cape Ann, a coastal destination about 40 miles northeast of Boston, he has plenty of places to bullet towards and hide. His siege is testing the ingenuity of residents. Those without folding mirrors or garages have resorted to wrapping their side mirrors in plastic bags, sweatshirts, or towels. But the angry bird will not be stopped. Cracking the driver's side window of one man's pickup truck while the man was sitting in it. Pileated woodpeckers are notoriously territorial, especially during mating season, explains a member of the Ecology and Evolutionary Biology graduate program at Brown University. They become agitated when they see their reflections, and their testosterone levels are high. They're very ornery, ferocious, and strong, he explains, adding that their bill is the biomechanical equivalent of a hammer, and that it's probably just one single woodpecker that's been tormenting the residents of Rockport. Another longtime area resident, quote, was taking the chaos in stride. It's hard to be mad at anything that makes you smile, she says, adding that the experience was helping bring neighbors together. And finally, I knew for certain that this article came from the New York Times when the final line was, the woodpecker could not be reached for comment.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we'll tell you how to both eat your dandelions and destroy your dandelions. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls. 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Not number 1, not number 2, but lucky number 3. Lisa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. Where are you?
Harleysville, PA.
I know it well. What can we do you for?
So I think I might have a grub situation. That's for you to let me know.
Okay.
I have some dead patches all over the lawn, and it wasn't this prolific, and it wasn't a problem like this last year. We have about 2 acres here, and it just seems to be more and more, and we're just basically left with these dead patches, and it's a little bit weedy. I did a few random dig spots in mid-April to see if I could identify anything. And out of checking about 10 areas, I found one spot that had 2 grubs in it.
Yeah.
And I guess I just want to know what I have, what I could do about it, and when to do it.
So has your grass greened up for the season, that which will green up?
Yes.
And the brown patches, are there new ones? Or, you know, you still have the existing ones?
The existing ones are pretty much the same, and they are filling over a little bit, you know, now that we're getting into the prime growing season and cutting and, you know, all of that. But no, nothing new.
Okay. The way to check for grubs is wait till the lawn has been growing for about a month. And then go to a dead patch and literally try to lift it up like a piece of carpet. As the season progresses, the grubs move higher. Don't forget the soil warms up a lot slower than the air temperature. It's more like the ocean. You know, by the time you want to go in the ocean, the kids are back in school already around here. So that soil stays cold. But as it warms up, the little baby grubs go through what's called instars. They look the same, but just keep getting bigger and bigger until they emerge as Japanese or other Asiatic beetles. Now, do you see a lot of Japanese beetles in the summer?
In previous years, I've had some. It's never been a massive problem for me. I mean, I do get a little bit around my roses.
Everybody gets some around their roses. Yeah, I don't think you have grubs. Now, tell me how you care for the lawn. Or you said it's 2 acres. Does somebody else care for it?
Nope, we cut it. And we just let it go natural. I don't put anything on it. And we have clover and dandelions and wild violets and all kinds of stuff. It's lovely, except with the exception of the creeping Charlie that gets in there and stuff like that. But no, it's nothing. We don't treat it with anything.
One thing you have to say for creeping Charlie, it is the most sensational scent you can get when you mow it over.
Yeah. Well, yes. It was funny. I was mowing today, and I kept getting like whiffs of almost citronella. And I've never experienced that before on the lawn, but it did, you know, it rained quite a bit. And I'm wondering, maybe it was that. I don't know.
Ah, you got me. Creeping Charlie smells like sage when you cut it.
Oh, nice. I'll have to take notice.
So you don't really keep a good lawn. You just have an area where you can go out and play and do stuff on, but parts of it are dead. Now, do you know what kind of grass you have?
It's a little bit of everything happening out there. If I took a guess, I'd say fescue, but it seems like as time goes by, there's all kinds of things that seem to be cropping up. There's areas where it's grass gone crazy, where it gets kind of big, and then there's other areas where it's a little thinner and more billowy, but overall, I think it's a fairly hardy grass in between all the weeds and wildflowers.
Okay. All right. Well, that doesn't sound bad. What do you cut it with?
Lawnmower, a riding mower.
And do you change the blades every season?
Yes.
Do you know how high it is after you cut?
We never cut it down to brown. We don't take it super, super low, especially in the bigger fields. No less than an inch, I'd say.
Okay, so you're responsible. grass is a living plant, just like everything else. You can't keep cutting off the green parts and expecting it to do well. To thrive on its own, because I'm presuming you're leaving all the clippings behind, grass needs to be 3 to 3.5 inches after it's cut. You can cut as high as 3 inches in the sun. In the shade, you really should go for 3.5. Now, that's not going to give you a lawn that looks unkempt. It's going to give you a lawn that looks level when you cut it the height that's sustainable for the turf. It hides a lot of imperfections because you get a much flatter natural surface. And the grass doesn't have to crawl back from death after every cutting. That's a real bonus, too. So when it gets to a certain height and is getting the nutrition it needs, it slows its growth dramatically. People cut their lawn short thinking they won't have to cut as often. It's just the opposite. People scalp their lawns. They look out at it like a couple days later and go, oh, the lawn looks like hell. I better cut it again. Maybe I should cut it shorter this time. And these are the people where you see dirt blowing out the back of the mower. So raise the cutting height. Generally, on American lawnmowers, you want the cutting height to be about as high as it can be set to go. But right now, you're your own worst enemy. And if there is bluegrass in there, in the mix, bluegrass naturally spreads to take over bare spots and bad spots. So you'd be preventing that as well by not giving it a chance to get healthy and have some extra energy for lateral movement. So this summer, let's cut high. I guess with 2 acres, you don't supplemental water?
No.
Yeah. We do have a lot of dead grass around in the area from the extended droughts we've had in Pennsylvania. Remember, it wasn't that long ago before the weather guessers on TV were telling us, oh my God, don't light a spark outside. We're 8 to 10 inches below where we need to be. Well, that can affect grass, again, especially grass that's cut too short because it has no time to devote to root growth if you cut it too short. All of the energy it has is going to be devoted to trying to restore the green that you removed. There's nothing left, no energy left for root growth. So when you let it get the right height and it gets some rain and it gets all the solar energy it needs, bluegrass will fill in these bare spots. So raise that cutting height. I think you're going to be amazed. And if you still have some bare spots in late summer, then rip out those brown areas, spread a little compost in there, and reseed those areas with a grass that matches your existing grass as best you can. You know, it is really tough to match grasses. Some blades are pointy, some blades are flat, some grasses are bluish, some grasses are much more green. But take like a 4-inch square of good grass to your local nursery and tell them you want a grass that matches this as closely as possible. And then spread that grass at the end of summer, right after the last heat wave breaks, and put some compost on top afterwards or screen topsoil. Then be sure to keep those areas watered. But at that time of year, the soil temperature is going to be great. The grass is going to sprout and grow rapidly. And you should see those spots filled in within 2, tops 3 weeks. Whereby if you do it now, the grass will just burn up in the heat that's coming. So in our part of the country, you seed in the fall.
So you're talking like late August, early September?
Exactly.
Well, you know, my husband's going to love everything that you just said because I tend to cut around the house, and that's where we have more of our dead spots. And I cut lower than he does. He cuts the lower field, and he's always like, don't let the deck down. You got to lift it up. There's not a dead spot down there. He's going to love what you just told me today.
Well, you've proved me right, or he has. You have to thank him for me.
Absolutely. He's going to be tough to live with now, though.
Okay. Well, you know, you can be right the other 99% of the time.
Okay, I'll take it.
All right. Good luck this summer. I think you're going to do great, and bye-bye.
That's excellent. Thank you so much, Mike, for everything you do.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind you that this is the season of proper pruning. Always prune spring bloomers right after the flowers fade to ensure a full display next season, or prune them while they're still in full flower and you can display the blooming branches in vases indoors. But don't go indulging your inner Martha Stewart just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss a reborn American estate that combines the grandeur of the Hearst Castle with the horticultural muscle of Longwood Gardens. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000. 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, yes, you can eat them. Almost all the plant parts are edible, but most people just want to get rid of them. So we're going to help you deal with your dastardly dandelions in a safe, non-toxic, and no-bending way. In the meantime, it is time to welcome our special guests, Dr. Gina Wouters, who is president and CEO of the Planting Fields Foundation, and Patricia O'Donnell, noted to be a, quote, powerhouse landscape expert and contributor to the book we're about to discuss, which is called Planting Fields, A Place on Long Island. Gina, we're going to start with you. When I first received this book, I didn't look at it closely. I paged through it, and I thought we were looking at a British estate. So when I finally started reading and found out we're on Long Island, I was kind of astonished. But back in the day, this kind of place was not unusual for what's called the Gold Coast of Long Island.
That's right. At a certain time, 1910s, 20s, 30s, there were hundreds of properties such as planting fields or comparable to planting fields on Long Island. And, you know, that have exquisite gardens, really large properties, vast properties, and beautiful houses, architecture that resembles estate mansions you may see in Europe largely. But over time, you know, only a few of those are still intact and survived with both the landscape and the architecture together. And Planting Fields is very fortunate to be one of those.
Yeah, it started out with a wealthy family. But then what year did they kind of pretty much abandon the main house?
It was in 1955, actually, where W.R. Coe died. And a couple of years before that time, he had established Planting Fields Foundation, who I work for, as well as promised to give the property to the state of New York. So upon his death in 1955, that's where it went, to the state of New York. And initially for about 15 years until the 1971 or so, it was actually a SUNY campus, a State University of New York campus. And then in 1972, 73, it became part of New York State Parks and was a public site.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was so pleased is people can come visit. And I have to say restored estate, because if I read correctly, the main house burned down. It was abandoned for a decade or more. You know, it's amazing that enough of it survived to be rehabbed, which makes me think, how many of these fabulous Xanadus are we losing? If we could lose one, almost lose one, because it seems like it was dicey.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the main house, which is a really incredible piece of architecture, it, like you said at the beginning, it looks like you're stepping into an English country estate. It's a Tudor Revival architecture style. At one point, that building was a white elephant. No, it was totally out of fashion. It was required an immense amount of resources to maintain, to heat, to just, you know, keep it intact. And so there was conversation at one point, I think it was in the late 80s or so, or early 90s perhaps, that should we even keep this building? Should we demolish it and just focus on the Arboretum? Fortunately, that did not happen. And that's actually the Coe family, the descendants of W.R. and May, intervened and decided to make it a house museum. And so in the 90s was when it was refurnished and when tours began of the home.
And I should mention, when I first received this, I thought, oh, it's a coffee table book. And in one sense, it is. You could nail four legs to this thing and put your coffee and tea and donuts right on top. It is a big, heavy book. But as I got deeper and deeper into it, it has a lot of text, a lot of great stories that often you never get to hear about these places. And I should add, it has modern and old photographs, sometimes of the exact same area. You can tell pretty quickly if you're looking at a black and white photo, it's from the heyday. And I presume if you're looking at a color photo, it's from recent years.
Right. Yes, that's correct. And all the photography in the book was captured for this purpose, and probably over the last 3 to 4 years. So it's captured planting fields evolving over the years and the different seasons. That is, I think, really something that, you know, Monticelli, the publisher, is recognized for. They create really beautiful books that are easy on the eye that you could just flip through if you'd like, but they are also very substantive. And so to have these five core essays by the most noted scholars, historians, preservationists in their own respective fields is very special. So I like to think it's a coffee table book, but a very substantive one that for the first time ever tells a definitive story of planting fields. Nothing like this had ever existed before for planting fields. One of the color photographs, I perhaps you saw, but it's on page 88. It's actually like a drone shot of the house within the landscape. And if you look very closely, you can see in the horizon line, the skyline of New York City, which we'd never saw before until producing this book. So that was pretty amazing to see that proximity and that context with Manhattan.
One of the things I like about even doing this interview is, you know, you'd think that this would be in England or Wales or something like that, but it's not that far outside of New York City.
It is less than 30 miles. So really very accessible and easy to get to. Also, it is a New York State Park site, so that means it is accessible price-wise. So from November until sometime in May or April or so, it's free to visit. And then from April to October, there's an $8 per car fee. So in that sense, the community nearby and abroad really should be enjoying this year-round. There are trains that go to Oyster Bay and Locust Valley, but it is a place you can spend easily a whole day, 409 acres. You can only imagine all the exploration there is to do. So that's one of the things we hope this book does, is that it really puts planting fields in front of a much broader audience who otherwise wouldn't have heard of us.
So I'll talk to Patricia about some of the structures that are horticulturally oriented, but some of the interiors literally blew my mind. How do you describe that painted bedroom? What was her name who lived there?
May.
Maykos. How do you describe that painted bedroom? It is totally immersion. I would be lost if I woke up in that room.
So there are two rooms like that at Planting Fields. The one, Mako's bedroom, is exquisite. It is actually a reproduction of the original. And it was by an artist named, American artist named Robert Winthrop Chandler, who was an Astor descendant. He also created the Buffalo mural, which is in the breakfast room. It's also, there's an image of it in the book. But it's true what you said. The murals he creates are on all the walls and the ceiling and really envelop you in a space. His work, Robert Winthrop Chandler's, as well as other artists like Everett Shin, who the Coes commissioned in the 1910s and 20s, really add this entire new layer to understanding planting fields and recognizing that the Coes were patrons of the arts, of very avant-garde artists of the time. And so that's a really interesting part of the story and a very important aspect that we have to preserve every single day and engage the public with, too.
And before we move on to Patricia, one last one for you. How in the world can you describe, quote, the outside in to someone who's never seen it?
The contemporary installation? So that's a great question. So that project by Diana Al-Hadid, who is an American, Assyrian-born American artist, she was our Catalyst 2022 artist. Catalyst is this project that engages living artists to do site-specific work. With that project, she took the room that you actually just mentioned, Mako's bedroom, and she inverted it. And she wanted to take the inside out and bring it out into the landscape, into the, what we call the taxis field. So that it was a cube on all walls. You see this room. And then within it, there's a Venus dogwood tree. So it's really a room for a tree. So it's part of a series of projects we do every year where we commission a contemporary artist to respond to the site.
All right. This has been great, but I got to move on to Patricia O'Donnell, who we're going to talk more about the landscape architecture and the plants. Thank you. And Patricia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
I'm happy to have you here. Now, I just wrote down some random notes as I was reading the book. And one thing that grabbed me right away is the Camellia House, which reminds me of like the Victorian orangeriums, where you have these tropical and semi-tropical plants in fabulous glass houses over winter. And it looked to be immense. It looked like it went on forever. It even had its own little indoor pool.
Yes, the Camellia House is quite a treasure, and it occurred fairly far into Coe's ownership because he was very engaged in horticulture and he was working with the son of Charles Sprague Sargent, who headed the Arnold Arboretum for decades, a Robeson Sargent, and a really intense horticultural knowledge. So Robeson Sargent and Coe worked together to obtain a camellia collection, but Coe was unaware that they weren't all going to be able to live outside. There are some that can live outside in Long Island, but the Camellia House is celebrated every year in February when the blooms bring forth the spring prior to the spring arriving outside, and it's quite a fabulous setting for a distinctive camellia collection.
I have no idea what could be a better way to escape the month of February than to visit the Camellia House. I was blown away just by photos of it.
Yes, it's an incredible collection, and it continues to be curated and cared for and augmented.
Now, as I mentioned previously, I love the fact that we go from black and white to show the estate in its earlier days and color to represent today. One black and white picture that jumped out at me is the Rose Arbor in 1926.
Yes, the Rose Arbor is a very interesting detail of the gardens, which are clustered around the house. This particular designed landscape flows from one space to the next, so the arbor hoops provide this long corridor to walk through, and just extremely fragrant with roses, particularly in the early weeks of June.
And we still have it, right?
Yes.
So that's going to be maxing out in a couple of weeks, really.
Yes, with the wet spring, you know, it's always plus or minus, but usually the weeks of June are the best for roses and rose display.
Now, another black and white image I loved that immediately made me think of the Hearst Castle was this giant yew tree that was bald and burlapped. I mean, but it looked like the size of a small house almost, and it was sitting out on top of a lawn waiting to be planted. So like Hearst himself, it looks like they, rather than let things grow slowly, they moved in a lot of mature, huge plants.
They did both. It is 409 acres, and the garden spaces are definitely graced with important specimens. There was, among the rich in the early 20th century, a bit of a competition about who could have the best and nicest plants.
Of course.
In addition to the taxes you're talking about, they brought two really huge beech trees across Long Island Sound from Connecticut to plant. So this is a very expensive practice. And in our work as landscape architects who are always renewing places of heritage, we always suggest to plant small because the plants recover better. So in that many thousands of dollars work to bring two beech trees across the Sound, one thrived and the other died.
Well, I'm lost in thought just imagining them coming across the Sound and crowds gathering. to watch this. Well, if I were listening to this interview, I'd be planning a trip, especially if I lived on the East Coast. And for New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, it seems like a slam dunk that this is a fabulous place to visit that is probably underutilized by tourists.
I think the local public have been welcomed very well in recent years, but you're correct that the knowledge of this fabulous landscape, all 409 acres of it, is not as widespread as it could be, and certainly a place to visit.
And you guys have done a excellent job in bringing it up to snuff. And I was so happy when I got to the part that it was open to the public, that it was a New York State park. So we have been speaking with Dr. Gina Valters, president and CEO of the Planting Fields Foundation and book contributor and powerhouse landscape expert, Patricia O'Donnell. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us today. I'll just mention again that the name of the book is Planting Fields, subtitled A Place on Long Island, and people can get more information real easy to remember, right? Plantingfields.com?
.org. Sorry, .org.
Okay, I should know better about the org. All right. Well, you two have been delightful. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and share this note from Park Ranger Jeff Erb about an endlessly fascinating American fruit. Quote, I have been restoring populations of pawpaw at local parks in Chester County, PA. Warwick Park now has about 30 trees planted, and Black Rock Sanctuary, Kenilworth Park, and Coventry Woods each have 5. There is also a pawpaw patch on the Schuylkill River Trail in Spring City, with approximately 30 trees of varying sizes. But don't go breaking out the pawpaw finder just yet, because we'll be right back to help you deal with dandelions. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. It's a very frequently asked question. Is there any way to revitalize your tired old potting soil? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal how to introduce that old soil to the fountain of youth, plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. And yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you how to both eat your dandelions and or destroy your dandelions, whichever way you happen to prefer. But before that, another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Elizabeth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Elizabeth doing great?
I am in the northeast of Pennsylvania in the Lehigh Valley region.
Okay, so are we. That's where we broadcast from. So, what can we do for you?
So, I have these two plants that are planted right next to each other, and they're entangled now. And they both have these little black, I guess they're nest little eggs, aphids maybe, on the stems. And haven't noticed any change in it.
You did send us some pictures, and it looks to me like you got aphids. It's a very common garden problem. The best way, and I mean, this has been shown to be better than sprays, including chemical sprays, in studies at universities, is with sharp blasts of water.
Look.
We're talking adjustable nozzle, laser beam sharp, cradle the plant that's infested, the part that's infested, in one hand, and blast the rats off. It is hugely satisfying. They go flying all over the place. And most of them will not recover. The shock and everything like that, that aphid will not be back to bother you. And if you want to have some help, there's two things you can do. One, you can buy ladybugs. Now, these are sustainably collected. Now, when you get the ladybugs, they will be dehydrated. They'll be very thirsty. So what you want to do, maybe just put, in this case, a soaking wet paper towel or two in with them. Let them get something to drink before you put them out. Then do not put them out during the day. The big kick against ladybugs is, you release them and they fly away. That's because you're releasing them at daytime. They are programmed to fly during the day. So what you do is you saturate that part of your garden. You really wet down all the plant parts. And then you simply shake the ladybugs out onto the wet plants at sunset. And now they've got water. And pretty quickly, they're going to find aphids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So although the adult ladybugs eat a fair share of aphids, it's their larval form, which is a crazy lobster alligator looking. You know, this is the complete metamorphosis. They look nothing like the adults. So if you see creepy crawlies on the plants near where you've released ladybugs, leave them alone, because each larva, so to speak, will eat 40 to 50 aphids a day. So, you know, some of the ladybugs are not going to make it. You know, they may have died during shipping. They may have gotten too dried out. But you always get enough to get a good start. And if you provide water, you know, in this case, it is perfectly okay to water any time because you're doing it for a good reason. And aphids keep showing up. They will live there. They'll register their kids in school. They'll start building a garage next to the plant. And they will raise their families there. Why? Because it has everything they need. There is also an insect that's even better called the green lacewing. That's a very diaphanous, almost fairy-looking creature. They're absolutely beautiful. And their larval form, which is very similar to that of the ladybug, they are so ferocious, their common name is aphid lion.
Ooh,
and
I
you can purchase these in egg form on cards that you just, you know, make sure the plants are wet, and you just put the card, like, near the top of the plant somehow. You know, maybe paper clip it on, or one of those things you use to reseal potato chips, and they will slowly hatch and they will come out in their larval form. So they're going to get right to work. And again, if conditions are right, they will remain. They will take up residence at your place. And finally, you can investigate pollinator plants that are well known for attracting these specific beneficial insects, and plant those around the areas where you're having trouble, and they'll fly in from the wild as well. because they're there for the pollen, and if they see aphids, they're going to go right to it. That's it, and just make sure there is a water source during dry times over summer. Even a bird bath that you just dump out and refill once a week.
Okay. Are the aphids harmful at all to the plants?
Yes,
they are.
They are sap suckers, and they congregate in such numbers that they can literally suck the life out of a plant.
Okay. All right. So I do want to get rid of things.
Yes, absolutely. No coexistence.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Take care.
Bye-bye. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling Getting Rid of Dandelions Without Danger. As promised, we continue to answer Lisa, who lives, quote, here in the Lehigh Valley, who asked about getting rid of dandelions in her lawn. I explained last week that if you treat your lawn correctly, which very few people do, the lawn will crowd out weeds without direct assistance from you. But I also promised to actually answer her question directly. So let's start with the positives. Although experts feel that dandelion pollen in the yellow flowers, not the puffballs, is not as nutritious for pollinators as other plants, there just aren't many pollinator plants blooming at that time. And the yellow flower heads in my backyard, where the neighbors can't see them, are very attractive to bees. Virtually all of the plant parts are edible and highly nutritious, except the stem, which contains a milky, bitter substance. To get the best flavor in salads and spring tonics, the distinctive and nutritious leaves should be harvested as early as possible, before the first sign of buds appears in the center. Now, after that, they're still edible, but they get progressively bitter as the plant matures, just like lettuce. The young leaves also make an excellent substitute for spinach and other greens in sautés and stir fries. Michigan State University Extension notes that, quote, dandelion flowers are a great addition to pancakes or fritters. Just add 1/2 to 3/4 cup of plucked flowers to your regular pancake or fritter mix. Choose large heads that are fully in flower and gently pull the petals away from the green base. This is a great activity for kids who want to help in the kitchen. The flowers are a good source of antioxidants as well as vitamins A and B12. The flowers are also used famously to make dandelion wine. You'll find lots of recipes online and dandelion syrup. The root is edible, but requires washing, peeling, and cooking to remove enough of the bitterness to be incorporated into soups and stews. Those roots are an excellent source of calcium and other nutrients. All right, here's what you want. Dandelion removal. The absolute best way to deal with unwanted dandelions is with a stand-up root puller. That's a long metal rod with a small cage at the bottom and a step plate you use to activate the tool. You pull the handle at the top straight up and the cage opens. Then you center it over the offending plant and push down gently until the top of the cage is at soil level. Then you place your foot on the step plate and push it down. This will close the cage and allow you to pull the plant out of the ground, root and all, without bending over. My old original root puller, the Hound Dog, doesn't seem to be available under that name anymore. But I found a surprising number of similar ones online, like the Breeze Touch 39-inch detachable 3-claw stand-up weed puller tool. Not sure what's, quote, detachable here, but it's in the name, so I kept it. Amazon has a video of it in action, so you can see what I'm talking about. The Fiskars line of high-quality gardening tools offers a version with a four-claw cage. It's called, ready, the Fiskars Four-Claw Stand-Up Weed Puller Gardening Hand Weeding Tool with 39-inch long ergonomic handle with easy eject mechanism. Whew. As noted in the name, comfort is integrated into the tool, which has a unique ergonomic handle. It also comes with a lifetime warranty. I really like Fiskars tools in general, and the entire line is ergonomically designed to cause less stress to your body. All styles of this device are no bending over. You pull the weed, lift it out of the ground, position it over a bucket or trash can, and use the top control to open the cage. You can recover all that calcium by composting the bodies with lots of shredded fall leaves. And finally, my favorite tool, the Flame Weeder. It's a shepherd's hook made of curved metal. You attach a small camp stove-sized propane bottle to the top, the short end, push the electric igniter, and a flame comes out the long end. Move the torch over the weed, and it will visibly desiccate. You're only supposed to make the plant wither, but I won't tell if you linger for a while and taunt it, especially if you're from Chicago, Philadelphia, Brooklyn, or Queens. But the most fun is when the puffballs begin to form. Just get close to them with the flame, and they explode into munchkin fireworks. Fun for the entire family. I checked Amazon under, quote, flame weeders, and most of the models are way too large and complex and unwieldy for a homeowner to use. Stick with the simple shepherd's hook design. The Flame King model they offer is the perfect example. Cautions: have a bucket of water, or even better, a garden hose standing by in case you set some dry leaves or such on fire. Be careful handling the device when you're done. The nozzle where the flame comes out will be extremely hot for the next 10 minutes or so after use. Set it down where kids can't get at it, and don't put it down on the lid of a plastic trash can. Or, so I've heard. Well, that sure was some timely advice about plucking, eating, and just plain getting rid of your dandelions now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes! My producer is threatening to plant more dandelions in my dirt if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. That's 610-694-8100, and follow the prompts to reach us at You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, please, please, please include your location. And be sure to visit our Facebook page for something new every day, important updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast platforms. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when a falling apple bonked him on the head and convinced him that he had just discovered gravity. Thanks to our special guests, president and CEO of the Planting Fields Foundation, Dr. Gina Valters, and powerhouse landscape expert and book contributor, Patricia O'Donnell, for being with us today. Once again, the name of the book is Planting Fields, A Place on Long Island, and you can learn more at plantingfields.org. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGriff, and I'll be keeping a close eye on my great garlic, titanic tomatoes, and puny little pepper plants until I can see you again next week. Hey, it's okay, really. Peppers take much longer to gain some size, and mine look healthy, all green and glossy. They're just a little small. Actually, they're really small. But they're getting bigger, hopefully.